Major funding for the following edition of Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Good TV this week on Soundings. Join me now for conversations about television, history, and the American family. You'll hear from Ken Burns, the documentary film historian, and from Robert Schrag of North Carolina State University.
We are a nation that does not write letters anymore or keep journals. We are in danger of really being cut off from our past. We suffer from a tremendous national amnesia, and it's very, very important not to abandon one of the very causes for this amnesia, television, but to learn how to use it,
right.
Not manipulate it, but to use it in an honorable fashion, to perhaps develop what I've called this new Homeric mode, to tell our stories, our histories, in an honorable fashion. That's been my mission now for 10 years.
I think the thing that makes a bookworm and a TV addict perhaps one and the same person is a feeling for dream weaving, a feeling for stories that take you away and bring you back again. I find it in television, too, and my children find it in television, too. I think one of the major themes of Taming the Wild Tube is that it, television, can be a good dream weaver, just as books are.
Welcome to Soundings. First on the program this week, Ken Burns talks about his recent television history of the Civil War. After that, I'll talk with Robert Schrag about his new book, Taming the Wild Tube, A Family's Guide to Television and Video. Ken Burns' television narrative depicting slavery and emancipation in 19th century America was broadcast on public television last fall. Entitled The Civil War, the series ran for 11 hours over 9 evenings. According to Ken Burns, the war between the states was the defining moment in North American political and social history, a window on the national experience that provides insights into the present.
Tell me about how you figured out what to, I guess the way to put it would be what to leave out. I mean, you had so much of a story to tell.
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head. That is the challenge of producing the Civil War. Despite its length, 11 hours, 9 episodes, it is, in fact, a carved-down version, and television imposes its own kind of terrible editing on the process just because of the nature of the medium. Mm-hmm. We left lots on the cutting room floor. We wanted to tell the history, not just from the top down, not just from the Lincolns and the Lees, the Grants and the Davises, but also from the bottom up, and to tell it from an emotional context. I'm really a kind of historian of emotions, not just the dry facts and dates.
Well, tell me, for example, you talk about the top down and the bottom up. Obviously, you had to deal with people like Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth and the generals and military strategy. You use a couple of characters, Elisha Rhodes and Sam Watkins. How did you get on to them? How is it that they served your purposes to tell the story of the Civil War from the bottom up, as you say?
Well, we were looking for two ordinary soldiers, two grunts, if you will, and Sam Watkins' memoir, Company H, is a very, very well-known memoir that was written by Sam. He served in the 1st Tennessee Regiment on the Confederate side and wrote it in the 1880s. Elisha Hunt Rhodes is a little bit more of an interesting and fortuitous story. I live in the little village of Walpole, New Hampshire, and a fellow villager had, when I began this project, just published his great-grandfather's diary called All for the Union, with a very, very small, almost non-existent press in Rhode Island. And I bought it almost out of obligation to a fellow townsman than a sense that I was going to find yet another Union narrative, and we were toying with using dozens to be our northern grunt. Mm-hmm. But Elisha Hunt Rhode, who served in the 2nd Rhode Island Regiment from right after Sumter to right after Appomattox, is the most incredible memoir that we read.
It's almost as though this man had a sense of what was happening to him from the long perspective, as though he were not writing his own history, but the way he appears in your film, The Civil War, there is a wonderful continuity there.
Oh, right? Absolutely, and that's what we were looking for. He's actually rather naive. He doesn't seem to see too much more than himself, but what he ends up reporting on events in his refreshing honesty and directness speaks volumes and approaches a kind of awkward eloquence. With the exception of the institution of slavery, there are no villains.
Well, let's talk about the institution of slavery, the role of the blacks themselves in the Civil War. There's history, there's revisionist history, there's the revision of revisionist history. What about that? How did you choose your points of emphasis?
Well, I don't like to apply the ists and the isms to it. We're very, very proud of the fact that we had an opportunity to tell the story, often neglected, of the role of blacks. Heretofore, for the most part, especially in popular works and movies and popular culture, blacks have been supposedly passive bystanders to their own deliverance. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Oh, those wonderful quotations from Frederick Douglass give the lie to that.
Read by Morgan Freeman, by the way, and I think in a performance as equal to his Driving Miss Daisy or his Glory performance, we were proud to correct these myths, to strip away the damage done, or at least begin to strip away the damage done by Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. I read one reviewer said that I had spanked Scarlett O'Hara and sent her to bed without dinner. If I have done that, then I have succeeded. We are very pleased to be able to be the agents, to be the messenger that delivers this extraordinary message.
Ken Burns, is your series on the Civil War, is it an anti-war film? I think of things like Paths of Glory and films like that. How do you place yourself in that universe?
Well, I'll tell you, I thought starting out that I would end up making an anti-war film. Certainly my sympathies lie in there, as most rational human beings must feel
one
about war.
Yeah.
It became much more complex than that, in a way. I can't say that it's a pro-war film. It certainly isn't that. There's just a sense that slavery had lasted long enough, that there are some good fights, and a lot of the Civil War is a good fight. I don't mean to say that we haven't shown, and I think tragically so, Southern perspectives without blame, without guilt, that we haven't shown the horror of war, that we haven't been very direct with what the experience was. But it's gotten beyond the simplicity, in a way, and I don't mean to denigrate it, the simplicity of merely an anti-war track. This is the most defining moment in the history of the United States. It made us who we are. Everything that came before it led up to it. Everything since has been a consequence of it. Before the war, we said the United States are. After the war, we said the United States is. Mm-hmm. This war made us an is. That's what the film is about. It is a window onto who we are as a people. And that can embrace anti-war. It can embrace the South. It can embrace the North.
Well, one of the things that I loved about the series was the opportunity that you gave your viewers to linger, to look and to listen. I remember there's an old literary saw about showing and telling.
Yes.
And I want to salute you for your ability to invite the viewer into the photograph and to not only enjoy something that's palpable and concrete, historically speaking, but to think about what was going on, the social circumstances surrounding that. Now, am I giving you too much credit?
No, we really wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, in this MTV generation, there's we pride ourselves on being able to quick cut, and we talk about how quickly the mind can receive information. But that's merely a physiological ability, that the eye and the mind in coordination are able to pick something up. Real meaning and emotion accrues in duration.
You're sounding very old-fashioned all of a sudden.
Oh, I am. I'm a very, very conservative filmmaker because I know that the fastest way to the heart is with duration and time. It's not to say that this is boring, that it isn't unfunny, that it isn't dramatic or powerful, or even, in fact, entertaining. It's just that there is something extraordinarily mechanical and unemotional about the quick cutting that we see on an MTV. Whereas if you stay, it's true, you can receive an image, say, of three Confederate veterans standing by a fence like that.
Right.
And you can cut away. Which is the tendency of most productions now. But if you linger a little bit longer, and a little bit longer, and longer, suddenly you are paid back tenfold.
Is there one of these characters way back then that you would love to have sitting here at the third microphone and talk to, ask a brief question? Who might that be?
Well, without a doubt, one would wish that we could bring Mr. Lincoln back for a number of reasons to see what he looked like, hear his voice, talk to him, shake his hand, and thank him for his life. He's the most extraordinary human being I've ever come in contact with, ever gotten to know, and my films are personal in that respect. I'm very drawn to them. Lots of other colorful figures I'd love to have watched. Nathan Bedford Forrest from a distance. I'd love to have seen Stonewall Jackson going into battle with one arm raised, he said, to keep the blood balanced. You know, he also...
a peculiar man, a lot of strange beliefs.
Oh, it's unbelievable. He used to... He didn't like pepper. He thought it made his left leg ache.
Wouldn't send a letter if it was going to be in the mail on Sunday?
Exactly, but his troops got so used to him fighting on a Sunday because he figured he was that the Lord would be more with them. He's just an amazing, amazing general and a fantastic character.
What about the women that you present in the series very quickly?
Dorothea Dix, Clara Barton, Mother Bickerdike, a wonderful woman who worked with the Western armies, the Union side, brewing barrels of coffee and keeping the sanitary conditions up. At the end of the war, Sherman, in referring to her, said simply, "She ranks me." I thought a wonderful sense. So you've got to understand the Civil War is the practical birthplace of feminism. Everything before had been philosophical writings. Now women discovered that they could run farms, that they could run businesses. They'd been told for millennia that they were ill-equipped to do this. Well, suddenly they were faced with the fact that they were doing it. It wasn't that hard. And they could serve as nurses. They could get out of the house. But in this country, all school teachers were men. And after the Civil War, women entered the teaching profession, thank goodness. And that was good news. Women, even over 400 documented cases of women disguising themselves as men and fighting bravely alongside. Clara Barton poignantly describes a young man, soldier, wounded, that she tries to tend, who he resists until, in finally opening up the shirt, realizes that why the soldier was so anxious not to reveal his chest.
Ken Burns, thanks for stopping by the National Humanities Center. We look forward to your films on radio? You got one coming up on radio, and then one, A History of Baseball.
A History of Baseball, yeah. My men will be playing out in the fields instead of lying dead in them, which is a refreshing change.
Ken Burns was executive producer of the television documentary entitled The Civil War. The 11-hour series garnered the greatest number of viewers in the history of public television and is now available on video cassette. The companion volume, also entitled The Civil War, was published by Alfred Knopf. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Our topics this week are television, history, and the family. You'll hear next from Robert Schrag of North Carolina State University. Robert Schrag is the author of a new book entitled Taming the Wild Tube, published last year by the University of North Carolina Press. The book's subtitle is A Family's Guide to Television and Video. In his book, Bob Schrag argues that turning on the television doesn't necessarily mean turning off the mind, especially young ones. Here is Bob Schrag.
It is uncontrolled for the most part. It is a wild medium, but there are good things in the wild tube as well as bad things. And my concern is that we figure out how to take this runaway horn of stories that comes pouring out to us. Television is voracious. It needs thousands and thousands of hours of programming simply to fill the screen while we turn it on.
All right. Now, let me get this right. You are not suggesting so much that we change the medium, that we change the nature of what we see on television as families, as you are suggesting we need to understand how to talk to our kids about it.
Yeah, but given the process of television, given the fact that television will give us exactly what we ask it for because of the commercial nature of the medium, if we as an audience, a whole total audience, begin to ask more often for good things than we do now, we will get them more often than we get them now.
Well, now, isn't that, after a fashion, what you've just said here, Bob Schrag, capitulating to the network executives? You know, this whole business of we just give the people what they want. Well, if that's the case, why are there so many television critics and so many family members upset at what comes out of the television?
I think we have to realize that in the minds of the network executives, what we want is what the largest portion of their audience wants, because they then sell those numbers to advertisers who advertise products to us. And as Pogo said years and years ago, we have met the enemy and they are us.
Right. But
we, as individuals and as individual families, we may want something very different than what commercial television offers us. But I think we're beginning to see commercial television and independent video producers whose works end up on videotape perhaps more often than on the network airwaves, we're beginning to get what we want. Let me give you an example. The Anne of Green Gables series that came across on PBS a couple of years ago is a wonderful example of a new kind of television drama for young people, for families. My daughter loved it when she was six. She goes back to it now that she's eight. And the Disney Channel has now picked it up as a continuing series.
All right. Now, I will concede you the worth of programs like that, Bob Schrock. But on the other hand, for every Anne of Green Gables, we have a watered-down Terminator 25, et cetera, et cetera. What do you say to that?
Without a doubt. The thing is, we need to go back and figure out how long our kids are going to be watching television anyhow in the course of a week, for example. My kids get 2 hours a day. Okay,
maybe that's a fixed rule in your house.
That's a fixed rule in our house. Maybe 3 hours a day on weekends. And I retain the prerogative to give them more if I want to. But by and large, we're talking then maybe 15, 16 hours a week. There is enough to fill that with quality program, especially if we balance it as we do with pre-recorded stuff that I record Nova because it's on too late for them. They watch it during my prime time. We rent old movies for them. Everything counts, okay? If it's on video, comes through the screen, it counts for their time. It doesn't matter to me that in any given day there's 20 hours of garbage out there as long as I've got 2 hours of good stuff.
What do you say, Bob Schrock, to the situation, if not to the people who are creating the situation, where you have all the junk coming out of the set and parents are not doing what you are doing? They are not as conscientious. I don't detect a self-righteousness in your tone, but there are a lot of people who sit the kids down and say, there it is, it's a babysitter.
There are two approaches to that. One, and of course the one I most firmly advocate, is to buy my book and learn how to be a good user of television.
All right.
But more realistically, perhaps, than to assume everybody will be as concerned about it as I am, is twofold. One, we just got some good help with the passage of the Children's Television Act.
Now, that's the reduction of the number of commercial minutes. Is that what you're after?
That's really not important.
Okay.
Because most stations were meeting that anyhow.
Okay, so what is important here?
What's important is that, once again, for license renewal, stations have to demonstrate that they are meeting the educational needs of children. And there's only one thing that a broadcaster's afraid of, and that's losing his license. Suddenly, we can begin to say there's simply not enough good stuff here for kids. And suddenly, broadcasters will have a reason to listen. Because before, what's the only reason a broadcaster would listen? If I can increase my audience, if I can sell my advertising for a higher rate. Children's television is a lousy market for selling advertising, which is why most of the programs we were getting were done on a barter deal with toy companies who would make the program and give it to the broadcaster, who would essentially show a new 30-minute commercial for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Bart Simpson T-shirts to the kids.
Now, wait a minute. That's not a good market for television advertising, a 30-minute commercial?
You don't get a lot of people watching the commercial who have the expendable money to go out and buy your product. So the broadcaster can't charge a high rate for his advertising. So, no, it's not a good market.
Let's talk about some of the particulars that you raise in your book, Bob Schrock, Taming the Wild Tube. How should parents talk to kids about television and what they see on TV?
Well, they need to begin, first of all, very early, talking to their kids about television and teaching them the kinds of things that we want them to know about television. The premise is kids are very sophisticated. They know TV.
That's your premise, or
no,
that's social?
A premise that people hear. My kids are very sophisticated about television. They understand what's going on
but
out there.
But they're not, huh?
No, they aren't. I teach a class for gifted 9 to 11-year-olds about television, and this last week we were talking about commercials. And they had no idea that you had to pay to put a commercial on television. They thought they were sort of public service announcements to let them know what the cool kids in the world were doing.
Mm-hmm. Many, many programs.
Little mini programs that showed them what the young, beautiful kids in their age group were doing.
So you would have parents make that distinction for children.
Very young. I advocate that you start teaching as soon as your kid begins to focus on the characters in Sesame Street, mm-hmm. the three golden rules of television. Rule number one, there is a difference between a character and a real person.
Hmm.
Rule number two, there's a difference between reality and make-believe. And rule number three, there's a difference between commercials and programs.
Bob Schrock, tell me how you think about television in our schools. Is it doing good? Is it more of a detractor than it is a benefiter of our kids?
Once again, we have to remember that television is simply a medium of communication. It brings information from one place to another. So the question really has to be, what kind of information is being brought into the schools through television, and what's the impact of that?
So you wouldn't object, for instance, to this Channel 1 experiment where the TV set go in the classrooms and there are particular commercials played for these little mini audiences?
No, there are a couple of reasons why I think an innovative school system and an innovative teacher can use Channel 1 to their own benefit, maybe outside the intent of Whittle Communications in selling them the program. But nonetheless, let's say for example, sit around at home and collect television commercials designed to persuade college students so I can take them into my classroom and say, look what they're trying to do to you.
Yeah.
Channel 1 brings them in tuned for that audience. So you sit down with that audience and you say, okay, now remember, as we learned a long time ago, there's a difference between a program and a commercial. A program is there to entertain you or inform you. A commercial is after your allowance. These things are after your allowance. How are they trying to persuade you to part with your money? What kinds of values are they manipulating? Are they showing you that you have to look this way, talk this way to be popular, therefore buy their product?
You are telling us that we have to become as sophisticated in our consumption of television as we like to think of ourselves in terms of our consumption of the printed word.
Exactly. And if there is a central message to Taming the Wild Tube, it's that the parent has to take the active role in the evaluation and the examination of the video product that they allow into the family and into their child's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the upfront early work, as I say early in the book, let's talk to six-month-olds, let's talk to one-year-olds, let's talk to 2, 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, you don't have to do nearly as much work with the older children. My older daughter is 8 and a half, soon to be 9 years old. I'll leave her alone with the TV. She is truly, I can say, a sophisticated viewer of television. She knows what she likes. She knows what she doesn't like.
So you've created some trust there.
Yeah.
As well as some instruction.
I trust her judgment. She knows she is frightened by programs, that she'll have nightmares. That's simply her makeup. Her little sister is not the same way.
She goes,
"Let's watch that scary part, Daddy,"
the little one says. But the big one has come to know what she can and cannot like and tolerate, and she's a judge of it. She's good.
Bob Schrock, let me use a couple of wonderful words. We're talking about families and television, sex and violence. What about them?
I think the issue of sex and violence, and most people who talk about television use that as one word, sex and violence. the issue of sex and violence on television becomes, I think, most of a problem with adolescents, because adolescents, obviously there's the whole body of literature about children and violent television and their belief when they watch violent television that the world is a more violent place. That, if we teach the golden rules and keep an eye on content we can control, adolescents are going to watch what they want to watch.
Hmm.
And adolescents see television as not truth, necessarily. They're, especially if they've been taught, they understand that television is somebody's words and somebody's drama being presented. But they do see it as potential options for reality.
So it doesn't cause their behavior, but it certainly shapes and helps to influence it up to a point.
Yeah, it provides models that have greater and lesser degrees of credibility.
Uh-huh.
people used to watch All in the Family and say, my, what a wonderful, insightful, socially liberal, innovative, gentler, kinder view of American society. And then the research indicated that half the people who watched the program thought Archie was right.
Reinforcement.
Yeah, so the model, sarcasm and irony don't carry real well to adolescents.
And the same thing is true about sex and violence.
Exactly. And we see on television a lot of models of sexual behavior that unfortunately can be deadly in the 90s. We see on programs like Dallas immense amounts of promiscuity and unprotected sexual activity. That can kill you these days, and adolescents need to get that message. They aren't. The statistics tell us that teenagers are the single fastest growing AIDS population in the country. There may well be a relationship between their unprotected sexual activity and the models of sex that we see on television.
Well, can't television in its own way become the answer to the problem that it creates, by way of education?
It certainly could, and some programs are beginning to make some steps in that direction. There is a soap opera, I believe it's The Young and the Restless, that has done a number of plot lines that do teach young people about concerns that they need to focus on, eating disorders, sexually transmitted diseases, and I hear my students talk about those programs. So yes, we don't always have to treat television as the bad example. Television can become an effective teaching tool, and if we become critical consumers and consistently ask for that kind of information, then it will become profitable for the industry to offer us those messages, and then we'll get them.
Robert Schrog teaches at North Carolina State University. Robert Schrog's new book is entitled Taming the Wild Tube, A Family's Guide to Television and Video. Taming the Wild Tube was published last fall by the University of North Carolina Press. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Soundings on Good TV is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 560. That's program number 560. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassette. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings. Next week, medicine and social ethics. Listen for a discussion featuring two physicians, Stuart Bondurant and Philip Riley. Stuart Bondurant is the dean of the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Philip Riley directs the Shriver Center in Waltham, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this edition of Soundings came from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Good TV, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations about television, history, and the American family. Ken Burns, the film historian, discusses his 11-hour public TV narrative about the Civil War. Robert Schrog of North Carolina State University talks about his new book entitled Taming the Wild Tube, A Family's Guide to Television and Video. Good TV, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.